All right, here we are. Welcome back to the Book Wave, the Book Club podcast. Today we're looking at Lord of the Rings, Part 5, Return of the Kings, Part 1. And I'm your host, Scotsley, joined today by William, as always.
Hey, guys.
And Jason.
Oh, hey, guys. Glad to be here.
Yours.
All right, Mr. Nose in a Book. Why don't you give us a quick recap of where we are in this section of the book so we can go forward with our conversation here.
So Lord of the Rings, Book 5, starts after Gandalf and Pippin and them are leaving Isengard. And Pippin had looked into the Palinor. Is that what it's called? Palantir, thanks, Will. And so Pippin and Gandalf, they're riding off to Minas Tirith, where Lord Denethor is at the Tower of Ecthelion, where the White Tree had once grown. And while they're riding, Pippin's kind of like wondering to himself, you know, what in the world are wizards and where do they come from? When are they going to leave us? And he's just kind of like perplexed and in a daze after looking into the Palantir.
All right. So there's a good question to start off with. What are wizards? When will they leave us?
Well, it's an archetype, right? I think that's a big question. We're just going to jump in on that. Like the wizened old figure.
I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and stuff about Lord of the Rings since we started, and I heard one comparison of like there was a guy trying to say like everything in the Bible was archetypal, or everything in Lord of the Rings was archetypal and could be found in the Bible, except for Gandalf. That was the one thing that stumped him. I'm just like, well, that's interesting that someone who was like really into the Bible wouldn't find a parallel for Gandalf. I would think it'd be easy for them, but like maybe an angel, but like apparently there's a lot of things.
Moses.
That don't fit. Moses, yeah.
every day of the week. Are you kidding me?
You think so?
Well, and then maybe even Aaron with his crazy magical breastplate, but definitely Moses has a staff, does magical tricks, parts waters, communes with gods exactly like Gandalf does. Are you kidding me? Like, is was he even trying?
I don't know, man.
Well, like the wizards, weren't they supposedly created by these higher beings called the Ainur?
Wait.
Well, I don't know. I haven't read the Silmarillion, Jason, but yeah, I think he's a Maiar, and he's part of the pantheon of, you know, religious backdrop to this entire universe, but we don't know that yet.
Yeah, there's two blue wizards, a brown wizard, the gray
wizard,
the white wizard. Yeah.
Well, for all of the background and like story and the Silmarillion, like with these Ainur and these kind of godlike creatures, it doesn't feel like there's a really big religious culture, at least that I kind of was able to perceive.
I think the elves show it best, right? Like, because, and like most races have that impact of Gandalf showing up and them knowing Gandalf and having heard of Gandalf and that he always shows up and he always brings trouble and he's literally this mythological permanent being that has a plan and a direction that he pushes people onto paths to fulfill great things. You know, he's sort of an element of fate, kind of like Moses coming down from the mountain with two tablets and telling people how to live their life, right? Like that the wizard has wisdom, sees something, and maybe you agree with it, maybe you don't. Maybe you go to war over it, but I think that we'll always have wizards for as long as we have people because they're archetypical. You know, you evolve into a wizard if you walk down the right path.
So you're kind of saying that the elves embrace that spiritual or religious culture more. What do you think, like, do the race of men in the story believe in that religious aspect, or do you think Tolkien was trying to say that, you know, they got rid of their religion and they started following like Saruman and this dark side?
Well, if you look at the society that they're in, right, like they're a warring society on horseback with little to no communication with outside sources, and it's hard, right? And it's top-down distribution of wealth. So your day-to-day existence is going to be rife with things to focus on that isn't, rigid and fleshed-out religion, but they have superstition, right? They know about the trees and they know about the stories, and mm-hmm. and there's like the early signs of religion. And when you look at the elven culture, they're magical and they're in tune with the divine light that is all of existence, and they literally dip, they drop their robes and they go on to their afterlife. They have no fear of their afterlife because they know what it is and they have that understanding of it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, dwarves is an interesting metaphor for, you know, capitalism. Maybe they're so focused on their monies and riches and digging deeper, and they're distracted by that, and that's their focus as well, right?
Yeah, and they show some of the dwarfs, at least in the Hobbit story, that they were a bit greedy with those riches. But I kind of noticed that, like with Pippin, as soon as he gets to Minas Tirith and meets Lord Denethor, that he just like drops right down on his knee and like swears fealty to him.
Hold on, we're doing a disservice if we're not going to look at the Hobbit's interpretation of this religious experience as well, because like they don't have that the way I see it. What they have is they have life and their enjoyment of it as the highest ideal, and they have dedicated their existence and their families to collecting information and being able to reflect on these facts, and they have rituals in their community and ceremony in their community. On a birthday, you send all your friends gifts and everybody's getting gifts all the time, and they love to eat and they love to drink and they love to smoke, and they live life to its fullest, and that's a wonderfully divine expression that I'm sure Ayn Rand would probably be happy with.
Yeah, and so you're specifically talking about the hobbits, though.
I feel like Joseph Campbell would be happy with that too. It sounds a lot like follow your bliss, you know?
Yeah.
It's probably no surprise that like one of the hobbits is one of the heroes in this book. Well, the next book.
All the hobbits are heroes in these books, man.
And maybe that's the metaphor for the best, most focused version of a highest form of human, you know, like when in times of crisis ethics kick in and you jump in, but in times of peace you live life to your fullest, you engage in rational barter with your community, and you experience happiness. And the threat of being ignorant to the actual affairs of the world.
Yep, you got a point there.
And yet from that ignorant life, they've birthed some of the most crucial elements of these wars and these struggles that we read about in the book. So, you know, if you can have these warriors and thieves and gardens that are ready to step into the battlefield when it's time, that's probably the perfect mix.
Yeah, I think there's a line somewhere in this book where Aragorn is talking to one of his fellow rangers. He's like, it'd be crazy if the hobbits actually knew what we did for them, but I think that would change the relationship quite a bit. I think it's better that they didn't know, because then they might think of us as, you know, savages, you know? It's like, it's quite symbiotic relationship that the humans have with the Shire, because it's like a guardian angel that allows them this like haven of the Shire where they can follow their bliss, but like the rangers sacrifice so much for it to defend it.
Like police.
Yeah.
like law enforcement.
Sure, if that's the parallel you wanna, it right? fits. Right? It works. It fits. It works. You're not wrong.
Well, you know, like during this whole book five, Sam and Frodo, they're like sacrificing themselves so everyone back home can follow that bliss. Right. We don't like hear much about Sam and Frodo in this particular book, but like everything that's going on now, like they're out there trekking through Mordor and like.
Yeah. You mean like our troops?
The Fellowship is like SEAL Team 6, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
So it's just interesting that Tolkien like writes in that these hobbits basically have to go through the hero's journey in right. order to protect that, you know, which is most sacred to them.
And every hobbit, you know, accepts the call to arms, you know, like you alluded to earlier, Jason, Pippin joins Denethor's army, and then Merry right after joins Theoden's army as they go on the march.
But what's interesting about Merry is he not only joins the army, he does it no matter what, you know, and he like sneaks into it.
Yeah, like he's dedicated to it. He's sneaky about it, and then like he goes off with whoever will take him, you know, like, you won't let me ride? Fine, I'll find someone else to go with me.
They're like, oh, you're too young, too short, too weak. You'll just be a burden. And he's like, no, I'm going to do this.
Right.
And I'm going to help.
Yeah. I mean, there's some interesting differences between the kings that they're loyal to. Like, Merry riding with King Theoden, and he's saying to them, you know, exactly what you just said, you know, you're shouldn't go out there and fight. Just stay here with my daughter Eowyn. Whereas Denethor, on the other hand, is kind of going mad. I don't know what you guys think about that, but you know, he's going mad and basically telling his own son Faramir and Pippin, go out there and risk your life.
Yeah, like, oh, you're breathing and you can walk? Here, take a sword, kid. Go save me.
Yeah.
Go die saving me.
Yeah, go die for me.
So, like, why do you think those two kings were so different? Did it mean something? Or, like, what made Denethor a bit more crazy and suicidal than Theoden?
I think it has to do with the circumstances of their own downfall. And with Theoden, you have this subversive Saruman who's sneakily eroding his mental faculties, and it's not even anything that Theoden was aware of. He had been bested, and Gandalf shows up and clears away all of that garbage for him, and he's like, oh, thank goodness, there's hope. And they ride off with hope, and Denethor lives on the edge of doom, and he's literally waking up every day looking out his front door and seeing a potential threat. And so he's living in fight or flight, freeze or appease.
Yeah, he's got nothing left to do. Like, there's no progress bar. He's just waiting. Whereas Theoden, like, he's on the march. It's like, okay, keep ourselves busy. Keep the troops busy. We can make a difference if we just keep moving forward. Where on the other hand, it's, yeah, I'm just waiting for death, sitting here on my hands.
They're losing ground, they're there for decades, and it's always there, this black pit, this other country that hates them and wants their utter destruction, and he's getting the numbers from all of his troops, and they're like, oh, we're down 100 today, and we've lost this many kilometers of the front, and he's like, well, this is hopeless, and so he starts tapping into this Palantir, trying to see the future, you know, trying to use this magic that he doesn't understand, and it's like WebMD, you know.
Yeah.
And so he goes on WebMD and he's like, likelihood that the Mordor will win, and WebMD is like 99.99% sure. Yeah, cancer, death, all of your loved ones are gone, and he's like, oh no. And it's just this terrible downward self-inflicted spiral where he surrenders his own mental faculties by continuously exposing himself to misinformation and fear.
It'd be like a boxer looking at all the odds against them. It's like, oh, shit. Everyone thinks I'm going to lose.
And it's like, meanwhile, the odds are always against all of the things, all of the time. And that's not the point. If you focus on that, you lose. But, like, there are people that are winning every day because they're not thinking about the odds. They're just doing the best they can. Monday to Friday keeps going. And Denethor, instead of thinking about ways to improve his situation, just kept dreading it and freezing.
There's no aim there at all. Like Jordan Peterson would say, you have to have an aim or you're not going anywhere.
And his aim was just like, I'm afraid we're going to lose.
Yeah.
And I wish I had the ring.
Yeah.
But you're right, Scott. Like, Theoden's literally following the light of the beacons to go help. Yeah. He's like, got to go help. And Will, was there like something different that you noticed about the book and the movie regarding the beacons?
Well, yeah, they were lit to begin with. Like, this was a huge plot change. The entire story of Pippin.
Yeah, why'd they change the books, Will? Why'd they change it in the books?
Well, I don't understand what would compel a man to turn the story of getting a look at the troops and meeting the family of the troops and learning the passwords as Pippin's storyline. Why would he trade that for, hey, dude, climb up this tower and light something on fire? Like, why was that the trade? Like, it was a really good storyline. I really appreciate it. He saw the fear in these troops, you know, again, reinforcing what I was saying earlier, watching the reinforcements come in. And they're like, wow, that's not many. Every single time. It's like, oh, there's the forces from such and such country. There's like 12 of them. That doesn't help.
I think maybe Peter Jackson put it in there to like play on that rebellion ethos, you know, like the revolutionary go against the king.
Well, and that was just it too. Like, he changed Denethor. He changed the steward, not the king. Thank you very much. He changed him from this, like, multi-dimensional character who, when Pippin first sees him, he thinks that he looks like a wizard almost as well. And he turns him into just this hateful, despicable, insane man in the movies, whereas there's depth to him.
Right.
Yeah, he kind of came off as intelligent in the book, but I felt...
Really intelligent, like stupid intelligent.
Yeah.
Over time that like he either went insane or something. Like, Scott, do you think that he had a Palantir at one point, right? So did that do something to him? To help push him over the edge, you think?
I'd say so. Like, we see what it did to Merry. Like, even when Aragorn used it, he was like, I could barely handle it. Gandalf was afraid of it. He covered it in a little blanket all the time. And the men were the species that were most susceptible to the ring. So if you had access to, you know, like one of the most powerful artifacts in Middle Earth, and we talked about this in the last video that we did, I think, where the Palantirs and all these stones were a lot more than just a 7-way walkie-talkie or 2-way radio, you know?
So, Scott, was it Merry or Pippin who looked into the Palantir in
Pippin.
I thought it was Pippin.
Pippin, the one that was traveling with Gandalf.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Aragorn traveling to the Paths of the Dead would be the next event.
Yeah, that was completely different, too.
Right.
He's leaving Rohan and going to these Paths of the Dead with Gimli and Legolas, right?
Isengard.
He's leaving Isengard. Okay.
Right.
I think they had already left Isengard. I'm not sure. It's been a while since we read this one.
I want to say he was leaving Eowyn because she was like really sad and wanted to go off with him, or she didn't want him to go. And there was a bunch of, you know, drama and tears shed.
Yeah, it was very heartbreaking. She wanted to go. He said, no, it's too dangerous. Then he only went with his rangers and his the other members of the fellowship. But he also sent the Hobbit with Eowyn as well, so.
Yeah, I kind of saw a parallel between the trio, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli, going off to the Paths of the Dead with, you know, what Sam and Frodo are doing at the same time in Mordor. Like, they kind of, there was a quote when Gimli's in the Haunted Mountains, you know, their choice is, you know, to find an ending and escape or run back in madness to meet the following fears. It's like the same thing Sam and Frodo are doing.
Yeah, like they both made the decision to leave the greater party for the sake of the greater party. It's like, if we just stay with those guys, then we're going to doom them. So Frodo makes the decision to just leave on his own and take only Sam with him. So that's kind of what Aragorn does. He only takes a small little party and then goes on his own.
What exactly were the Paths of the Dead and like the haunted mountain and caves they were going through?
I don't know. I was expecting them to find a bunch of ghosts, but...
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like in the movie, you know, they go up on this plateau, and then there's a cave system, and then there's like this whole undercity, which is gorgeous, and all these ghosts. But in the movies, it's like they go through a pass, and then they're in an open field, and they're running across a country, and then there's a town, and then they go through the town, and it's like just wide open world and completely different again.
Yeah, they hear like ominous voices or something, don't they? Like Aragorn communicates with something.
And they get to like an obelisk in the middle of a field on a little hill, and he calls them forth.
Hmm.
Who's they who he calls forth?
Oh, the dead, I would think.
Do you not remember?
No, honestly, I don't remember exactly who he was calling forth, because I watched the movie and then in my mind got the ghosts and whoever these they were confused.
Well, the origin story is the same in the books and the movie for the ghosts. They were the men that swore allegiance to Isildur during the War of the Ring and fled as cowards and were cursed to live on the plane of purgatory until they honored their promise.
So in the book, they were still living men, or they were like zombies?
They were ghosts, but they didn't show up.
Big ethereal ghostios that went, rah, woo. Am I wrong?
That's how I don't recall that. I don't recall that happening in the book. I do recall them feeling like there was a presence around them.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm referencing the movie.
At best. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah. In the book, it's all just woo-woo-y, and they haven't really gotten to any ghost parts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see in the sixth part of The Lord of the Rings if the ghosts actually show up. I'll be waiting.
So, if I recall, after that, they kind of jump back into the Siege of Gondor.
Yep.
Yeah, and then, he takes us back to Denethor, and like Denethor has gone like crazy at this point after Faramir gets like fatally wounded, and he's like gonna put him on a pyre, like a bonfire, and burn his son, who I believe Pippin is like, dude, he's not totally dead. He's like he's only partly dead. And
Yeah, he like wants to burn them both. And he's got the Palantir with him.
That's right.
And then I believe Pippin gets Gandalf, or maybe just Beauregrand.
He gets Beauregrand first, and he says, "This is going down." He's trying to kill himself.
And right, and he sends him, and then goes after Gandalf.
Yeah, and then when I also read something online that said, like afterwards, Beauregrand is like rewarded for that service, like killing three people to defend like his king, basically.
The way they left it, the way they left it at the end of this first book was that he might be in really hot water for saving Faramir because of that.
Yeah.
But right.
When Gandalf comes in, clears everything up with the Hobbit and then Beauregrand, and everything is okay in the end. Nobody gets burned alive.
Well, like Gandalf
except
had to
for
stop.
Denethor.
Yeah. No one.
He had to like.
No one who shouldn't have been burned alive.
When they went and got Gandalf, he was like fighting with the Nazgul rider, right?
Yeah.
Kind of had to stop what he was doing, and rush back there as like the protector of men.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as a result of that, like, that choice results in a different life being lost because of the fight that Gandalf didn't fight and because of who was then forced to take up that fight.
And that was Eowyn and Merry?
And Théoden.
And Théoden, that's right. Théoden, like, falls. And yeah. Merry, I kind of saw Merry and Eowyn as, like, I don't know, MVPs in the story.
Yeah.
Well, it's
a runners pretty, up.
Two on one, right? Pretty dishonorable, but yeah, Mary. Mary like stabs him in the knee, and then she stabs him in the face, and that was all they wrote.
Yeah. Like that was one part they didn't really change much in the movie. As far as I can remember, like the "no man can kill me, I am no man."
Yeah. But then they added it, like, or go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, what Scott had said, Pippin and Merry are literally on the same path. They're in the same battlefield. And in this last chapter of book five, you have Merry, you know, is it he stabs the Nazgul, right?
Yeah.
And then Pippin is like at the very end fighting with a troll.
Hmm. What?
At the very end of book five, they leave it with Pippin like stabbing his sword upward and this troll like belching black blood all over him, and he falls onto Pippin. It's like the last paragraph of the end of book five.
Okay.
I'm not making this up. It's right there.
Don't take your word for it, man.
Yeah, same. It was a while. Like I said.
But then you got Aragorn healing everybody with the King's Foil as well. And that was an interesting thing.
Right.
The royal blood has an impact on the natural world.
Well, hey, Will, what do you think would have happened if they had just not gotten Gandalf and he had continued battling and Théoden maybe didn't die in that outcome, that might have happened?
I think Théoden would have lived a long life watching his daughter Eowyn become a single old lady because Faramir would have died.
Ah, true.
And just let that sink in.
Yeah. Well, what do you think would have happened in this whole situation if Boromir had originally gotten the ring and taken it to Lord Denethor?
He wouldn't have made it, I don't think. I think it would have fallen into enemy hands. I think he would have ran straight at Saruman or Sauron. He would have just thrown it on, succumb to the call of its master, and it was just because it would have been a weak,
ignorant man. Isn't that one of the things? That's like what Gandalf tells Denethor, like why he couldn't have ever brought the ring, because he would have fallen into its like grasp.
Snap. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Gandalf is pretty direct about it. Like, yeah, if he just took the ring here, it wouldn't have been good for you. Would have just killed you all faster.
Yeah.
Gotta trust in the little hobbits, the pure souls.
Yeah, because, I think I said this before, but, like, you know, the hobbits, every single time they show up to do a good deed, from the Hobbit to now, it's like they're just trying to do it because it needs to be done so they can go back to living their good life. Whereas I think the men want to win the war to have won it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Will, I think where I may have confused you earlier when I was talking about Merry and Pippin in the battle, I may have been confused. Merry was fighting with Eowyn in that battle with Theoden at Minas Tirith, and I'm thinking of the battle at the Black Gate, kind of more at the very end of the book, where, you know, the Black Gates of Mordor open and all the orcs like are pouring out onto everybody there. That's where he...
Is that even in book five?
Are you spoiling things?
Is that this is in the book five, guys. The Black Gates of Mordor, open your books up. Isn't that like the last chapter?
Yeah, then Pippin stabbed upwards, and the written blade of Westernese pierced through the hide and went deep into the vitals of the troll, and his black blood came gushing out. He toppled forward and came crashing down like a falling rock, burying those beneath him. Blackness, the stench, and crushing pain came upon Pippin, and his mind fell away into great darkness.
Yeah, that paragraph was metal, but read like the very next one. It's like, it's cute. I liked it.
So it ends as I guessed it would. His thought said, even as it fluttered away, And it laughed a little within him ere it fled, almost gay. It seemed to be casting off at last all doubt and care and fear. And then even as it winged away into forgetfulness, it heard voices. And they seemed to be crying in some forgotten world far above. The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming!
Yeah. I confused you earlier, Will, but that's where I... was thinking about Pippin in the battle. It ends there with him like underneath a troll covered in like troll blood.
Right.
It's freaking cool. And then he's having this little, I always knew it in this way, like out on the battlefield.
I think Bilbo has a similar experience in The Hobbit.
Where in the Battle of Seven Armies.
Like, I could have died in my Hobbit hole, but here I am, like 7,000 miles away.
Well, I had kind of mentioned, I thought like an MVP runner-up might be like Pippi and Merin and Eowyn, but is there like, what's the opposite of like an MVP? Like, what do you call a foul on somebody? So we have the mouth of Sauron come out.
Yeah, he's pretty gross.
His emissary. Yeah. And he's like a man, apparently, like a mortal or some kind of sorcerer, right?
Yeah, he was supposed to be just like, in the book it described him as a regular guy, but in the movie it was like big creepy Joker mouth and a big metal helmet. Remember that shit?
Yeah, it was really weird in the movie.
That bugged me. That scared me as a little kid. Yeah, what was like the big speech he gave him? He gave them Frodo's like
Mithril.
Yeah, Mithril cloak. Like everyone's all sad, but Gandalf realizes that this guy only found one of the hobbits. Shut up, everybody. He only found one of the hobbits. That's kind of the vibe I got from it. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, it's like... No, go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say he's very strategic in what he said and what he let his party say. But I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, it's like at that point, I think it's just the same as in the movie, right? Like, if they did find Frodo, they're screwed. They're going to die anyways. Fight to the death. Great honorable battle. If they didn't, don't tell them they didn't, because then they'll redouble their efforts in finding him. Fight to the death.
Yeah. So, like, in a way, Gandalf really is the MVP because he let them believe that they had won already. He's just like, okay, we'll let Sauron believe he's won. All he's got to do is beat this one army. This is a Hail Mary. We know we're going to lose. Let's just do it anyway, because it's better to die on our feet than on our knees. But their ace in the hole is really still out there. Because even if Frodo's dead, Gandalf still has trust that Sam will carry it out. Because if he's like, he's not coming out to brag that he has the ring. He's just like, we got your hobbit. Like, ah, Sam's still out there. They only found one hobbit.
Because if they had found the ring, wouldn't Sauron himself, like, come out?
Probably would have been, like, kind of nuke.
Yeah, seriously. That would have just been game over.
Yeah.
And so I was also thinking, like, Sauron is just a manifestation of this other higher up being called Melkor?
Yeah, they mentioned that a lot in this book. That's a good point, Jason.
So are they, like, the same thing? Or is Sauron kind of like Melkor's emissary? Like, kind of like Russian dolls.
Yeah, I don't know, dude. They don't talk about that in this book, but that would be explained in the Silmarillion.
Yeah.
And I've never read these books, so. I don't know. They don't talk about that in the movies.
Right.
I didn't know there was required readings on the origin story of Sauron.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a god in Lord of the Rings until we started reading all this stuff. Now, apparently.
I really like this book, and I was really excited about the next book, of course, with Sam and Frodo's journey, but I think I finished book 5 like a month ago, and then just randomly the other day I picked it back up, open to just a random chapter, and was able to jump right back into it.
Nice.
I mean, like, I've had a lot going on in my life, so this is like one of those books where it's fun to delve into this other world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very enjoyable book, very easy to read once you're into it.
Well, where are the wood people in all this, the ants?
Those weren't the wood people we were talking about, but...
Oh, okay. You were talking about, like, humans?
Yeah, the Puckelmen, the wildlings.
Okay.
Like when Merry and Eowyn are traveling, they pass like a settlement of people. Like, that's what I said. Like, George R. R. Martin just, well, let's have wild people and we'll put them on the other side of a wall or something. Just like Got the Puckelmen. Like, everything that I was just like, okay.
These guys, well, these guys
live off the land. They have like a sense of honor and loyalty to each other, and that's all there is to it.
And they were critical in guiding Theoden's army through this forest and away from ambushes on the road to Minas Tirith, which would have been, you know, completely crippling for that besiegement of Minas Tirith.
Yeah, but so the question is still like, where are the ants? Because we saw them at the Battle of Isengard in the last book. But they're not present in this book. And I don't see them coming, like, going forward. Do they just, they're kind of, like, minding their own business now?
They probably not marching on Mordor. Are they?
Well, Treebeard is the steward of Isengard now, right? Like, he's got a guard duty set up in Isengard. That's how the Two Towers ended, I believe. He was installed there because Saruman refused to leave.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's very atypical for them to get involved in the comings and goings of humans or elves because they've been there since the dawn of time. And the only reason they got involved was because Saruman needed to be stopped. Because it was impacting them and their way of life.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Not everyone in the whole kingdom's getting involved. Like, it would still be negative for them if Sauron won this battle and took over and continued on westward. But I guess they're just waiting and seeing what'll happen.
Yeah. Well, the elves just don't even bother with the affairs because their time on the world is coming to an end.
Yeah, that's right, the elves. And
but other than that, other than that, everybody else, I feel like, is pretty involved.
Are there many dwarves in this story? Or not so many?
Well, it talks about the dwarves under the mountain, but they're not marching on Mordor.
No.
Yeah.
The only dwarf there is Gimli. Like, this is like a... This is like elves and men versus goblins.
Well, there wasn't even any elves, really.
Yeah.
They didn't show up to the rescue at Helm's Deep. The Ents did.
You're right.
So, no elves, no dwarves. It's just the...
Really is the story of men, mostly.
Men and hobbits.
Yeah.
And not really hobbits, just sort of representatives.
Yeah. They have a handful of other species, but it's mostly men on the battlefield there.
Yeah, small motley crew of mythological archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really difficult getting to the end of book five and not like wanting to continue reading on to book six. But I'm quite excited to see what happens.
Yeah. I'm gonna get all this finished in a week. I'll see you guys then.
Literally, you won't be able to put it down, you know, once you get into it.
Yeah.
Well, all right then. Until next time, guys.
Yeah. May the Force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
May the Shire live forever unwithered.
Beautiful.